From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. The president went to Russia to negotiate with Putin. North Korea fired missiles into the Sea of Japan. A Central American president was deposed. Ethnic riots broke out in China. Congress debated revolutionary changes in health care and energy policy. Oh, and we're at war in two countries. But the big story on Action News this week, the death of a pop star.
The many images we are tracking today, Forest Lawn Cemetery there in the top, Staples Center on the bottom of the screen, people still milling in.
Funny how the same news organizations that have pinched pennies by closing bureaus and firing reporters somehow scrounged up the resources for wall-to-wall coverage of a celebrity funeral. And why? Because, as Henry Luce famously observed, people make news, and dead people make more news, and dead superstars make even more news, and dead superstar man-child freaks possibly drugged into oblivion? Well, expense be damned. It's time to bring in the A-team, if, you know, they're up to the emotional challenge.
I'm fighting my own instincts here to be a newsman. I want to be a consumer of our own pop cultural history and the passing of an icon.
I think about I'm a fan of Michael Jackson's music. Love it. As a journalist, a reporter covering this, it's very difficult because, you know, I love Michael Jackson. At the same time,
I'm not embarrassed to say I was emotional, I was moved, and knowing you as I do, I know you were as well.
Maybe they were just choked up by the lack of civil insurrection among the trillions of mourners they'd all predicted would be laying siege to LA's Staples Center. Fox News's Greta Van Susteren couldn't believe her eyes.
No, I'm looking down and I see big chunks of open space in these seats. You know, I'm stunned at how many open seats. Now, there are people still coming in, but only stragglers.
Adam Housley is reporting that outside Staples Center, they're actually handing out tickets for this event. And I'm wondering now, with great respect and admiration for Michael Jackson and his talent, if the news media has not run away with this thing in a way that the people have not.
Oh, people paid attention, all right. According to Nielsen, 31 million Americans watched on TV and many millions more online. But maybe, because it was the only thing on, a survey of news coverage by the Project for Excellence in Journalism found that last week, 17% of the news hole for broadcast, cable, and print was filled with Jackson coverage. On network news, it was 30% of airtime, and that was all measured before the memorial service. For a media critic, this sort of episode is red meat. Bill Mann, writing for the Huffington Post, called it, quote, the most disgraceful coverage by corporate media since the days leading up to the Iraq War. That's a little harsh. My vote goes to Fox and CNN every single day. Besides, Jackson was one of the greatest and certainly weirdest entertainers of the 20th century. Rioting by ethnic Uyghurs in China may have more importance, but Uyghurs never paid $20 million to settle child molestation allegations or surgically turn their faces into albino Barbie. Of such matters, inquiring minds want to know. That fundamental fact led to one of the more bizarre bits of criticism from none other than the Reverend Al Sharpton.
You would think that Michael Jackson was convicted. You would think that he was just some weirdo and that he became famous for being weird. You would not think this man changed pop culture.
Never mind that he apparently missed the tears of Geraldo, but was Sharpton, the ringleader of many a media circus built on scurrilous allegations made before rooms full of camera crews, actually objecting to basic reporting on the bizarro world that was Jackson's life? But never mind that either, because even that was not the event's thickest slice of irony. That honor goes to a moment in the memorial service for a man whose tragic story began as a child forced on stage for an audience of millions, abusively exposed to pressures few children are equipped to bear. So who goes before the crowds and the cameras to eulogize him? His 11-year-old daughter, Paris.
I just wanted to say...
Speak up, sweetheart, speak up. Get close.
Ever since I was born, Daddy has been the best father you could ever imagine. And I just wanted to say I love him so much.
USA Today put a giant photo of Paris on its front page. The LA Times called her halting words the signature moment of the service. And the cycle begins anew.
You and I must make a pact. We must bring salvation back. Where there is love, I'll be there.
Newspapers, as we've so often reported, are in deep, deep economic trouble, mainly thanks to the collapse of the classified advertising market. And everybody's looking for present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Last week, as first reported on the website Politico, the Washington Post announced a cunning new profit center. Influence peddling. A flyer advertised small, private, off-the-record meetings with Post editorial staffers and key Washington policy figures, the first centering on health care and sponsored by Kaiser Permanente, whereupon people inside and outside the Washington Post commenced to wigging out and the paper scurried to retreat. Publisher Catherine Weymouth published a semi-mea culpa, accepting responsibility for rushing half-cocked into the salon business, but also noting that the flyer from the marketing department hadn't been approved by her or by the editors. However, says Post staff writer Paul Fari, who has been covering the fiasco for the paper, the plan that was agreed on by the business and editorial top brass was indefensible all on its own.
When the promotional flyer came out, it put the worst possible spin on what everyone had agreed was already the way to proceed.
Namely, that paying customers would have access to important officials and editors and reporters.
Not just access, but you will be able to bring your issues to people and you will be able to shape the ultimate outcome of whatever legislation or policy is ultimately crafted. And the idea that it was non-confrontational suggested that there would be no challenges made to anything that was said. That, of course, was not accurate or true. But again, people realize that no matter how you characterize this, once you get down to the basic facts of it, the thing itself could not stand.
I guess we should observe that while the Washington Post is caught in the salon mess, it didn't invite the idea of reporters and editors showing up at salons. That's been done before, correct?
That's right. There have been a number of publications that do it in one form or another. I mean, sometimes it's a salon, a small group gathering. Sometimes it's a big conference. The Atlantic magazine does something very, very close to what the Washington Post had in mind, which are these very small, intimate dinners off the record with a paid sponsor who is usually aligned with the topic that's being discussed. So influential people on, say, healthcare policy will sit down to a dinner, and it will be sponsored by a healthcare company with truly a vested interest in the outcome of this discussion.
Atlantic publisher David Bradley has weighed in on this subject, unapologetically observing that at the Atlantic salons, off the record is critical because otherwise Washington big mockers won't say what's on their mind, but they'll speak in prepared sound bites.
Well, I can't speak for the Atlantic and their journalistic practices, but I know around here that people were very upset by this and actually quite confused by it. We're all here to find out information that we can then share with our readers. That's the job of a journalist. And if you're put into a position in which you are explicitly told you may not share any of this information and people are paying for the access to you and other important people involved in shaping this policy, that just looks like the kind of inside deal that as a reporter you walk away from when it's presented to you by a third party. And here was our own newspaper putting its own journalists in that position.
Okay, so it's clear we're talking about finding new ways to raise money, in this case on the backs of the editorial staff's connections and credibility. Is that absolutely a non-starter?
It depends on what form it takes. Holding a conference in which journalists interview newsmakers in front of an audience in an on-the-record setting seems to me to be expanding the amount of information in the world and the knowledge that's available. That's what journalists do. In this case, the problem was it wasn't going to be public or even semi-public. It was going to be completely private, and that the Post was going to set up an operation that was closed to any of its readers, and none of it would be publicly accessible.
Now, I know you're in an awkward position of being a reporter for The Washington Post, reporting on The Washington Post, doing something that at least has the appearance of being unsavory.
Yes, I have to say it is a kind of hall of mirrors, and I'm constantly looking, you know, at various reflections of myself and not always liking the image I see. I'll have to say, though, that everybody in a position of decision-making who was responsible for this has been extremely forthcoming and has spoken on the record to me. And I can't ask more of the people I work with than what they've given me so far.
Well, that is encouraging. And I can think of a way in which this could have gotten at least one degree weirder. And that is if the planned first salon hadn't been about healthcare but about media— you had been the featured reporter.
I'd have to interview myself, and then I'd no comment myself.
Okay, Paul, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Paul Farig covers media and a whole lot of other stuff for the Style section of The Washington Post. Both Post publisher Catherine Weymouth and chairman of Atlantic Media Company David Bradley, who I just mistakenly referred to as the publisher of Atlantic Magazine, declined requests for interviews. Coming up, when a reporter was kidnapped recently, what ensued was a genuine media conspiracy. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people, this is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last November, New York Times reporter David Rode was kidnapped by the Taliban while reporting in Afghanistan. The Times was convinced that if the news were made public, Rode was more likely to be killed. So they convinced 40-odd news organizations not to report the kidnapping until 7 months later, when the reporter had finally escaped his captors. Whenever a journalist is kidnapped and the media don't report it, familiar ethical questions crop up. Is it fair to give journalists special treatment? Is it wrong to suppress news, even when a life may be at stake? This time, though, there was an added wrinkle. A Wikipedia user added information on Rhodes' kidnapping to Rhodes' wiki page a few days after he was captured. The Times called Wikipedia's founder Jimmy Wales and asked him to redact the news from the page. Wales enlisted some Wikipedia administrators to do just that and set off a cat-and-mouse game between the Wikipedians who wanted the information online and those who didn't, an enterprise that lasted for the entire length of Rhodes' captivity. Jimmy Wales joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So Wikipedia has gotten a lot of credit, all deserved, in covering news events that are unfolding in real time. I'm thinking of the London subway bombings, among many, many others. But that, I guess, can cut both ways, as it did in the case with David Rode, no?
Yeah, that's right. What our community is really, really good at is synthesizing information from many, many different sources. And the community spends a lot of time really thinking and discussing and debating about when should we take something as having been confirmed or not.
The usual answer is, well, Wikipedia may be wrong, but it's not wrong for long. In the case of David Rode, that wasn't the issue. The issue was, whether Wikipedia would be right and in reporting accurate information in near real time that this man's life would be endangered. Is that an issue that you had previously encountered?
No, it's not one that we had encountered in quite this way before. But because the New York Times was very successful in having their media blackout, it was pretty easy for our volunteers to look at it and say, well, really, under the rules of Wikipedia, we've never considered ourselves a wide open free speech forum where people can post speculative things. We just look at it and we say, well, yes, there was one report here and a couple of blogs, but really it's not being reported anywhere else, so who knows. Now, of course, I knew that it was true because the New York Times contacted me to ask what could be done about it, but it's not my obligation to report everything I know, just as it wouldn't be for anybody.
All right. I will accept that at face value. Maybe Wikipedia does not, in its mission statement, claim to be an upholder of unfettered free speech. And it's also hard for me to argue against the result here. After all, David Rode did survive this ordeal. But in fact, you had the ultimate sourcing on this. You had the New York Times asking you to intervene to make sure that none of this stuff would find its way into the Wikipedia. You knew to a moral certainty that David Rode had been kidnapped and that the reports that you had removed from the site were accurate.
Yeah, that's right. But then we also have the sort of deeper question, which I've struggled with and I assume the New York Times struggled with and I assume a lot of the other media organizations struggled with, which is the question of, well, what really is the best thing to do here? The New York Times told me that they were acting on advice that it would be best if it was kept quiet. And I just chose to believe that. If this had not worked, and let's imagine that Mr. Rode had been executed by his captors, then I think there would be a lot of pushback on all of us now saying, gee, maybe if you had reported on this, he'd still be alive today.
Considering the idea that Rode might not have come out of this alive, have you created any kind of fixed policy on circumstances like this, trying to anticipate what to do if something like this should arise again?
No, we really haven't, because every case is going to be somewhat different. You know, one of the interesting puzzles for me about this whole thing is when they called me and I said, yeah, okay, we'll look at it and we'll see what we can do. And yes, there's no reliable sources, so it's fine. I thought we had about 3 days. I thought, you know, it's already in this blog and that blog. It's such an interesting story. It's going to be picked up by the blogosphere. It's going to be all the rage, people speculating about what the hell's going on. And that didn't happen. I suspect that it would be much harder to pull this off a second time.
I don't know. This is a tough one. You know, this media double standard thing is troubling, but David Rode isn't dead. He's alive. So who the hell knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to say, I mean, we had some questions, you know, a conservative commentator said, well, they would never do this for Fox News. And I said, well, of course I would. I mean, that's not really the relevant point. This wasn't some sort of a liberal conspiracy. But on the other hand, there is this question of the media reports quite aggressively and gleefully when some blonde teenager gets kidnapped. And is that the right thing to do or not? And of course, that's a different kind of circumstance as well. The particular point of this kidnapping was presumably, as in the Daniel Pearl case, to create a bit of a media circus and to call attention. And denying that attention seemed useful. So I don't know. It's very puzzling. I hope we don't have to do it very often.
All right. Jimmy, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Jimmy Wales is co-founder of Wikipedia, where he volunteers, and chairman emeritus of the Wikimedia Foundation. One person who has spent a lot of time thinking about how the media covers kidnapped journalists is Micah Garin. In 2004, Garin was in Iraq wrapping up a documentary when 2 days before he was scheduled to return, he and his translator were unlucky enough to catch the attention of a local group of Shiite terrorists.
He and I were kidnapped out of a marketplace in Nasiriyah. They released 2 videos. One was an execution threat video. Then finally, I was released unharmed after 10 days.
Did they ever understand that you're a journalist and that there would be publicity hay to be made there?
From the start, our intention was to get it across to them that we were journalists. I think after a couple of days, they finally believed it because they looked very closely at what was happening in the media. And we heard from one of the guards that they actually watch the media and see who talks about you. And if it's friends and family, they said that, well, we realize that you're a journalist. If it's the military, then we think something else. But that still didn't stop the progression of events. It was 5 days into my kidnapping when I thought things were going well that they made an execution threat video.
That wasn't necessarily an idle threat because you were the first American journalist kidnapped since the abduction and murder of Daniel Pearl in Pakistan.
Yeah, it was a time in Iraq where kidnappings started happening more and more frequently. I knew about the risks. You just never think it's actually going to happen to you. I thought in captivity, you know, during the whole time that it was about 50-50. And from what we could understand from the kidnappers through my interpreter who spoke to them as much as possible, there were two brothers arguing about our fate. And as he said, one felt one way and one felt another.
Ultimately, they let you go and you get back home to discover what had happened in the press. How had your abduction been reported?
Well, the coverage while I was in captivity had escalated very quickly. And once the video execution threat was released, it became almost 24-hour coverage. News crews camped outside my family's homes. You know, it was just something my family actually had to deal with intensely as part of the process of trying to get me free.
So you weren't the beneficiary of the kind of widespread news blackout that David Rohde had the advantage of. Do you think that you were victimized? I mean, you got the mere stringer treatment while a full-time New York Times reporter gets the full-on blackout.
I mean, I think it was quite clear that there was no blanket effort on all the media to suppress the story in my case and in other cases following. It really depends on the circumstances. One thing that was very surprising to me was when I was released, I was flown out of Baghdad to Amman, and I was sitting next to an NBC reporter, and she said, "Thank God you made it out safely. We were really worried when four of our journalists were kidnapped in Fallujah 3 months ago." And that was a story I hadn't heard before and was not reported in the media. It had been successfully kept quiet until their release was negotiated about 3 days later.
I mean, it's certainly understandable to want to protect one of your own, and it's also equally understandable that the certain knowledge that publicity for a kidnapping is exactly what the captors crave because it gives them a platform. At the same time, as a journalist, do you think there's ever a time when news should be suppressed?
I think news is suppressed constantly. I think it's editors' decisions on what to print and what not to print. And I think a kidnapping is just another example of that. But I think people have to keep evolving their thinking about what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate in a kidnapping situation. And I would certainly err on the side of what's in the best interest of the hostage.
All right, Micah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Micah Garin is a writer, filmmaker, and founder of Four Corners Media. 40 years ago this month, the United States put a man, actually two men, on the moon.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
The global media moment, seen by about half a billion people worldwide, was the culmination of more than a decade of NASA trial and error, building rockets, weathering setbacks, and trying to outpace the Russians, and also forging an uneasy relationship with the press. Harlan Markinson is the author of a new book, Media, NASA, and America's Quest for the Moon. He says that the early years of the space program were reported on by a largely uncritical press, enthralled by the image of clean-cut, God-fearing astronauts who were going to put their lives on the line to win the Cold War space race for the United States.
And the mass media was very much in tune with perpetuating that image. They were depicted not only in training, but at home with their wives, in John Glenn's case especially, teaching Sunday school, those sorts of things.
All right, so everything is swell when the launches are successful, when Alan Shepard goes into space for the first time and John Glenn is the first human being to orbit the Earth. But there are accidents as well. Gus Grissom is trapped in his capsule after splashing down in the ocean. Later in the early Apollo program, Grissom and two other astronauts die in a launch pad fire. How did the press behave when things didn't go well?
I'll tackle the Grissom flight first. Beforehand, NASA had allowed the networks into the mission control to sort of shoot dummy footage of people at the controls and on a headset talking to the astronauts. And NASA said, use however you want to. So as radio calls are coming in from Grissom splashing down, here's TV inserting pictures of people in mission control when NASA didn't really shoot straight on what happened. The hatch came open, water came in. Of course, the big break was during Apollo 1. This is where you start to see the press being critical, not only asking questions of how this could have happened, but the way NASA handled the aftermath was just one bungling after another. The initial press release, the wording, there's been a fire, quote, involving fatality. Some that covered NASA regularly swear there was an A, involving A fatality initially. The head PR guy in Houston said, well, they died instantaneously. There was no suffering. Days later, the New York Times gets a hold of a tape from inside the capsule where there had been screaming, and one of the astronauts said, get us out of here. Just one thing after another where NASA just performed horribly in being up front and giving information and being contradictory, never really tying up those loose ends. And NASA took a real beating throughout that.
And didn't learn anything. I mean, it's got this love-hate relationship with the media, using the media to advance its program and then clamping down when there's something unpleasant to report. Did NASA ever come to terms with this dual relationship?
Yes, but not consistently. One of the interesting things about Apollo 1 is Julian Scheer, a former reporter, had taken over the NASA PR reins in about 64 and espoused what they called the open program, that, you know, we're going to show you what goes on. There's a problem. We're going to let you know about it. And that all kind of fell apart for Apollo 1 for whatever reason. But after that, when you got to Apollo 13, when there are the problems with the oxygen tank on board, NASA by that time has put a pool reporter inside mission control who's able to get information more quickly to the other reporters. In pockets, yes, they did learn from it. But then when we get to the first space shuttle explosion, they essentially made all mistakes again.
All right. So Apollo 1, there's a fatal accident killing three astronauts on the pad. But the next nine Apollo missions go swimmingly. And then there's Apollo 11, the most important space shot ever. We put a man on the moon, and it was a media event worldwide.
Yeah, and basically everywhere except China, which essentially didn't tell people anything about the mission, essentially anywhere else where there was a television available, people were tuned into this. You know, we think about how fractious the late 60s were and how one event, however briefly, brought not only the country but the world together for a few hours. It was quite remarkable.
Well, actually, more than a few hours. This was one of the great examples, first examples of wall-to-wall coverage.
Yeah, 30 hours if you're counting at home. Of course, Cronkite at CBS dominated, and he was completely immersed into this stuff. CBS had remotes in New York. They had another one out in Downey in California with models of the spacecraft, etc. NBC converted its giant studio into a space center. They had a full-scale model of the actual lunar module. Again, other than liftoff, a couple of broadcasts from inside the space capsule and the actual walk on the moon, most of it was not open to TV cameras. So TV sort of had to recreate a lot of this stuff, if you will.
Did the media actually ask the fundamental question of why? Were we there because of man's imperative to expand his frontiers? Were we there for missile development and for Cold War reasons? Were we there for pure science? Did anyone wonder why?
By large part, the networks were praised for their coverage of Apollo 11. In some circles, though, that was some of the criticism, that there was no real serious discussion of, okay, we're going to get to the moon, now what? Or was it worth it? A couple of the networks had a couple of discussions, one between Kurt Vonnegut and Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer, about the pros and cons of the space mission. 30-plus hours of coverage, there was plenty of time to do those sorts of things.
I want to ask you one more thing. Now, we're talking because of the 40th anniversary of the moon landing, but as you look at the coverage of NASA since, I mean, two horrific catastrophes and the end of the space shuttle program just around the corner, President Bush's declaration that man will explore Mars, it strikes me that through all of that, the public and media interest in the space program has substantially waned.
In looking at this, one of the interesting things was the support for the space program was more sort of peaks and valleys, really, in the 1960s. It was not necessarily sustained. There was a Harris poll that came out just a couple of weeks for the moon landing that 51% to 41%, the public thought that going to the moon was a good idea. It reversed the results of a similar poll a few months earlier. So it seemed like there was a major shift around Apollo 11, but a second question I think really opened up what was going on that asked, was the $4 billion a year for the space program worth it? And a majority said no, and that number had basically hadn't moved since the mid-1960s. So I think there were spikes of interest, John Glenn flight, the first spacewalk by Ed White, Apollo 11, Apollo 13 got a lot of interest. But by and large, I think the public was really ambivalent all along about space. They wanted to see the spectaculars. Of course, now that we've been in the moon, the spectaculars are gone. So what is it that's going to get the public interested in exploring space more? And that was part of what NASA was hoping to do by televising activities in space. They thought that it would make them willing to go out and spend more money for Mars exploration, et cetera, which never really turned out to be the case.
Harlan, thank you very much.
Thanks. It was great talking with you.
Harlan Markimson is an associate professor of communications and media history at Elon University in North Carolina. Coming up, Russian premier causes riot in supermarket and other absurdities from the Cold War. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As we just heard, the space race helped define the Cold War for a generation in the 1960s. The Red Scare and its brand of domestic anti-communism did the same a decade earlier. As the scare gave way to all-out paranoia over enemies in our midst, it wasn't only State Department officials and Hollywood directors who were victimized in the panic. Journalists, too, were identified as traitors and prevented from plying their trade. Most notably, Izzy Stone, who, after he was blacklisted, created his own newsletter called IF Stone's Weekly. It was, to be sure, investigative left-leaning journalism, often critical of the government and at times sympathetic to the Soviet Union. But the exact nature of Stone's relationship with communism and the Kremlin remains a topic of debate even today. Jackson Lears, a professor of history at Rutgers University, discussed newly published claims about Stone in the New York Times Book Review recently. Lears says that Stone's great genius as a reporter lay in his ability to ferret out simple, damning facts. Case in point, the Gulf of Tonkin, where the Johnson administration claimed the North Vietnamese attacked U.S. naval forces on two separate occasions, thereby justifying a vast escalation of the previously slow-burning Vietnam War.
And what Stone did within days after Congress passed this war resolution, basically, is to suggest strongly in his newsletter that the first attack had been provoked by counterinsurgency operations that had been underway in the country, jointly conducted by the U.S. and the South Vietnamese.
And the second attack never happened at all.
Precisely. The second attack never happened at all. So Stone couldn't prove this for sure right at the moment, but he pieced together enough evidence from fragments, including congressional testimony, to call the government claims seriously into question. And all of his suspicions were confirmed a few years later with the publication of the Pentagon Papers in 1971.
I mean, that's the astonishing thing about this. His supposition was borne out later by David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan and Morley Safer and the Pentagon Papers, and he came up with it within a matter of days after the incident that turned Vietnam from a dust-up into a full-fledged war.
That's absolutely right. It was one of the most remarkable accomplishments in the history of investigative journalism, I think you could say, given his physical condition. he was practically stone deaf at this point in his life. So he couldn't go to cocktail parties. He couldn't chat it up with inside dopesters. He could only look in the public record. But at the same time, he did have a larger critique in mind, and that was that the Vietnam War was sparked by anti-colonial nationalism and not by Moscow.
Now, that's I.F. Stone circa 1964. Let's go back about 30 years earlier. He was, I guess, a leftist firebrand, sympathetic to Stalin's Soviet Russia, as many, many, many thousands of Americans were, in believing somehow that Soviet communism was not only anti-fascist, but promised a kind of social justice not attainable in the capitalist West. But there are signs that early on he began to have misgivings about Stalin, no?
Well, yes, it's very interesting. I think he's very conflicted on Stalin in particular. And Don Guttenplan, in his new biography, provides a lot of valuable information on the twists and turns of Stone's ideological development. He is skeptical enough of what are the first purge trials, the trials that Stalin used to justify the murder of his opponents. When news begins to filter back as early as late 1934, Stone is already comparing Stalin, albeit briefly and glancingly, to Hitler in his New York Post editorials. Nevertheless, a lot of Americans believe that fascism was a much greater menace, especially if they were Jews, as I.F. Stone was.
Now, you mentioned D.D. Guttenplan's biography of I.F. Stone.
Yes.
But there's a second book out that asserts that Stone was not merely a fellow traveler, but actually a Soviet agent, if not on the payroll necessarily, at least on the roster, and was supplying information to the Soviets. What do you make of that allegation?
Well, I think that the charge that Stone was a Soviet spy or a Soviet agent is pretty close to being posthumous character assassination. I mean, I really think it's unconscionably overblown, and here's why. The evidence, such as I understand it, that's been adduced by Harvey Clare and his colleagues in the book Spies, The History of the KGB in America, shows that Stone met with a KGB journalist for a couple of times in 1936, and he told the Soviet agent about a couple of Americans who were going to be in Berlin. One was a journalist and the other was a diplomat, and who were anti-fascists and therefore potentially pro-Soviets. Well, this was not a state secret. There was no war going on with the Soviet Union at the time, so Stone may have allowed his fear of fascism to lead him to fraternize improperly a couple of times with the KGB. That is about the worst you can say, in my opinion.
Well, I guess really the ultimate question, at least as far as this conversation is concerned, was there anything that Stone may have done with respect to a KGB undercover agent that forces us today to question the quality or the credibility of any of his five decades of journalism?
He was a man who started out as a fairly garden variety popular front journalist with all the sentimentalities and blind spots that involved, especially sentimentality toward the Soviet Union and blind spots about some of its transgressions and abuses. But what I see in Stone is an intellectual growth as he comes to terms with the realities of the Soviet Union, so that by 1948, he sees that Stalin has unleashed what he calls an old-fashioned Russian orgy of suspicion of foreigners, intellectuals, and any kind of dissent. He comes back from the Soviet Union in 1956, and he says, "I feel like a swimmer underwater who must rise to the surface or his lungs will burst. Whatever the consequences, I have to say what I really feel after seeing the Soviet Union and carefully studying the statements of its leading officials. This is not a good society, and it is not led by honest men." He italicized those last words in his newsletter, and he then went on to say that the evil was not just in Stalin, but in communism itself.
Jackson, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Jackson Lears is a professor of history at Rutgers University.
This is the voice of Russian Premier Nikita Khrushchev, a voice which became familiar to Americans in the fall of 1959 when he and his family spent 13 days touring the United States.
50 years ago, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev flew to the United States at the invitation of President Eisenhower, in part to discuss the ongoing vexing issue of the fate of Berlin, but also to simply see America. With the Cold War in full throttle and mutually assured destruction, the doctrine of the day, Khrushchev crisscrossed the country in a whirlwind circus of a tour, from Harlem to Hollywood and points in between. Following closely behind was a flock of eager reporters who chronicled the bizarre trip, one of the first round-the-clock news events in modern journalism. Former Washington Post reporter Peter Carlson sifted through the newspapers of the day to piece together a funny and enlightening account of the visit. In K Blows Top, a Cold War comic interlude starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's most unlikely tourist, Carlson says that Khrushchev landed in the United States on September 15, 1959, at Andrews Air Force Base, where Ike and other American dignitaries awaited his arrival.
While Ike is making his rather dull little welcoming speech, Khrushchev was waving his hat and winking at a girl and watching a butterfly go by and generally stealing the scene. One reporter described him as a shameless vaudevillian. It was quite obvious to everyone that this guy was going to be totally unpredictable and he was going to do or say whatever he wanted to.
There were to be another, 12, 13 days of vaudeville to follow. Give me some of the highlights.
Well, he went to New York, where he was stuck in an elevator at the Waldorf Astoria. Henry Cabot Lodge, who was our UN ambassador, had to push Khrushchev's butt to help him climb out of the elevator. He also went to Hollywood to a formal luncheon at 20th Century Fox, and all the Hollywood stars were there, except those who refused to go, one of them being Ronald Reagan. But Marilyn Monroe was there, and Shirley MacLaine, and Frank Sinatra, and Zsa Zsa Gabor, and Dean Martin, and many, many others. And Khrushchev got into an argument with the head of 20th Century Fox, Spiros Skouras, about which one had risen higher from a more impoverished background. Khrushchev was very, very funny, and everything was going fine until he was told that he couldn't visit Disneyland that afternoon because they were afraid they couldn't control the security there.
Hence the title of your book, K Blows Top. He did, eh?
The title is from a wonderful Daily News, New York Daily News headline, Denied Tour of Disneyland, K Blows Top.
For me, such a situation is inconceivable. I cannot find words to explain this to my people.
He threw this temper tantrum and then sort of calmed down and went across the street to 20th Century Fox soundstage, where he watched Shirley MacLaine and 15 other beauties record a rather risque dance scene for the movie Can Can.
This number, appropriately enough, is called Live and Let Live, and it's a marvelous idea. Gentlemen.
He looked like he was enjoying it, but the next day, he told reporters that it was decadence. He said, mankind's face is more beautiful than its backside.
More poetic words never spoken. among the other stops was one in San Francisco, where a riot ensued in a supermarket, and a trip to Iowa in a corn farm there, where there was a battle royale between the press and the landowner. Tell me about those episodes.
In the supermarket in San Francisco, it was a riot not of people trying to hurt Khrushchev, but people trying to get close to him, touch him, and shake his hands. Those were the shoppers. And then the Soviet guards got around him, and that prevented the photographers from taking pictures of him. So the photographers, of whom there were dozens, they were climbing up on the meat counter, walking in the chicken. One of the butchers tried to haul one of them down. They were climbing on a display of instant coffee, knocking the cans down. The cans exploded on the floor. Then the shoppers started chasing Khrushchev around, some of them in shopping carts. They started tumbling out of the shopping carts. In fact, the Associated Press reporter wrote a great lead about it. It went like this. It was like the happy hour in a manic depressive ward, like the year of the locusts, like the bull in a china shop, like the night the dam burst, like crazy, man.
Okay, it was also like Crazy Man in Iowa when Khrushchev went to visit an acquaintance, a farmer named Randall Garst.
Yes, Garst had sold Khrushchev seed corn. Both Garst and Khrushchev were corn freaks. They believed that corn would solve the problem of world hunger and that corn would feed everyone and everyone would be happy. And Garst was appalled at all the reporters. So he had gone up to Khrushchev the night before and said, look, I'll come by at 6:30 in the morning at your hotel in Des Moines and we'll sneak out and I'll show you my farm without all these pesky reporters. Khrushchev didn't agree. He said it would be like a bride in the Caucasus eloping. So when they got to the farm, the place was swarming with the media, photographers, TV cameramen, and hundreds, literally hundreds of reporters. James Reston said everything was wired for sound but the hogs. And as Garst was trying to show Khrushchev the wonders of his corn crop, the photographers kept getting in the way. And at one point, he pulled a stalk of corn out of the ground and used it as a spear and charged the photographers. Well, these photographers were not raw recruits. They were the battle-hardened veterans of the Battle of the Supermarket. So they just stood still and held their ground and took pictures of this. So Garst started picking up silage from the ground and throwing it at the photographers. Meanwhile, Khrushchev was standing there roaring with laughter.
Now, the publicity was kind of a mixed blessing for Khrushchev. It showed him being very quick-witted and funny and unpredictable, but not always in a good way. He would go into these frightening, raging fulminations about the Disney trip, and there were a couple other incidents that, you know, made you really wonder whether this guy was stable enough to have his finger on the nuclear button.
That's true. On at least three occasions, he scared the hell out of the people who were watching him with one of these totally unexpected tantrums. And by the end of the tour, people in the press and State Department people who were along on the tour were wondering, is he faking these tantrums or are they real tantrums? So I asked his son, Sergei Khrushchev, who is now a professor at Brown University, who was on the tour. And he says, yes, he was mad, but he was also acting. He thought he could gain something by throwing these tantrums. And what he thought he could gain was to be treated better by the Americans. In one tantrum, he got upset at a question asked by the press, so he thought they would stop asking negative questions. In another, he had been insulted by the mayor of Los Angeles.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I want to say in the most friendly fashion, we do not agree with your widely quoted phrase, we shall bury you. You shall not bury us, and we shall not bury you. We're happy with our way of life. We recognize its shortcomings and are always trying to improve it. But if challenged, we shall fight to the death to preserve it.
After he was insulted by the mayor, he went through a regular speech of maybe 15 minutes duration and then lost his temper about the insult. In that particular tantrum, he said he was going to fly home early, and he reminded Americans that he was turning out missiles like sausages.
Peter, towards the end of your book, you quote the historian Daniel Boorstin, calling the Khrushchev trip the first pseudo-event manufactured for the sake of simply getting media coverage. But doesn't that gloss over the fact that this was the first summit between superpowers in the midst of a very tense Cold War?
Well, they had met before. Ike had met in Geneva. And of course, Roosevelt and Truman had met with Stalin. The difference with this one is that the big deal wasn't the summit, although Eisenhower thought that was the big deal. Khrushchev understood that his tour itself was what he was interested in doing. He knew that he was trying to get TV coverage to show his people back home and the people in the United States and around the world himself and his dynamic new Soviet Union, which was, he believed, on the rise. And he knew that it was a big TV show. So for the 10 days of the tour before they got to the summit at Camp David, Khrushchev was just performing for the media. And of course, the media loved it.
Peter, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Peter Carlson is author of K. Blows Top, a Cold War comic interlude starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's most unlikely tourist.
The bear flew over the ocean to see what he could see. He saw a friendly nation. He saw a friendly nation. He saw a friendly nation, and all of our people were free. Oh, Big Bear, go back and tell them, Big Bear, go back and tell them, Big Bear, go back and tell them that all of our people are free.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and TJ Vogt, with more help from Sarah Fidelibus and Kasia Glodke, and this week edited by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Bob Garfield.
Goodbye. Good luck. Friends.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.